So here's my argument, Stephen, for Austin Matthews belonging this early in his career on the list of all-time great players who have plied their trade in Toronto. When I watch this guy play, it's just different. He scores goals. He does things we haven't seen before. I'm more focused on that than I am on his lack of tenure to date. And I would be happy to listen to the argument that he's got to sign his next contract here and make it a 15-year thing. But when you look at this talent, it's different than almost anything we've seen.
Yeah, I would say it's, I think historically it's different. You know, how far do you want to go back, right? It is, you know, one of the odd, you know, the anomalies in hockey is that, you know, the Toronto Maple Leafs, ancient franchise that they are, you know, team that has had, you know, in the past, in the distant past, had Stanley Cup dynasties, won lots of Stanley Cups, almost has never had the best player in hockey in their roster. Never. Like, there's, you know, there's, like, I can't speak with authority about Babe Pratt, or, you know, or Teeter Kennedy, right? But those are the only two, there's only two Leafs have ever won the Hart in the history of the team. Now, Austin Matthews isn't going to win the Hart this year because there's another guy. And, but, you know, even to consider him, you know, 1B right now, you know, maybe him and Nathan MacKinnon, I don't know, you know, like who else is on that list? Nobody else is on that list at this moment. And, you know, the envisioning Austin Matthews winning a Hart Trophy is pretty easy. So, you know, right there, like Matt Sundin was a great, great player. Doug Gilmour was a great player, you know, wasn't an overwhelming physical presence. You know, if you look at him in street clothes, you wonder how he ever did it, but he did it. He was an outstanding player. Wendell Clark was a much beloved player in Toronto, but was never on that kind of a list. Frank Mihaljevic, at his best in Toronto, was a great scorer and a dominant player. Davey Keon, long tenure, you know, an all-star. But in that really, that rare, rare era where you say, okay, who's the best player in the world? There have been, you know, almost no Leafs in that conversation historically. And this guy is in that conversation. And so that's the, you know, like that doesn't mean, you know, that he has to play his whole career as a Leaf. It's, you know, but it's a significant, it's not a small sample size now, right? This isn't a one hit, 1 year wonder. You've just seen the guy get better and better.
When we talk about the best, though, usually you tie in how much success they've had, how many championships they've won. And me and Scotty were talking about that today. And I was saying, well, I need to see Matthews sign a second deal with Toronto and keep this pace up before I put him on my Mount Rushmore of Toronto athletes. How do you define a player's career in respect to, you know, if we look back at Matthews and say they don't get past the first round, can you still say he was one of the best Leafs and one of the best Toronto athletes of all time?
Yeah, because that's a team accomplishment, right? Like, how many Stanley Cups has Connor McDavid won? You know, he might never win a Stanley Cup. You know, does he belong in the pantheon? Yeah, I'd say he does. You know, if you're going to find, you know, that you just disqualified every Leaf who's played after 1967. So, you know, I think some of those guys are relatively significant.
I mean,
right?
Dougie Gilmour did win a cup in Calgary, but I understand your point, Stephen.
But if you're talking about, that's a team thing, right? Like, it's the Dan Marino argument. It's, you know, like sometimes you can be great individually and not have the team around you to win a championship. There's loads of examples of that. I think in terms of, you know, contracts and free agency and the way hockey, you know, the way professional sports works now, the guys aren't going to play, you know, necessarily play out. Even Aaron Rodgers is not going to play out his entire career with one team, it would appear. There's other, you know, other things, the business intercedes and players' rights intercede at that point. So, yeah, he doesn't have to be a lifetime Leaf. He just, you know, if he is a great Leaf for the duration of this contract, if he is in the conversation with the best player in the world for the duration of this contract, and the team falls short of a championship, which, again, entirely possible, you still look at it and say, boy, how many players in our lifetime, like, you know, just look, if you just want to do the eyeball test, How many guys have you seen wearing a Leaf uniform who are as good as Austin Matthews? Go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
so that's, that's you know, again, I think that's kind of objectively true.
With Stephen Brunn on leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. I was joking earlier with Ziggy, Stephen, that if I was still on the Blue Jays beat and we were in normal times, the first thing that I would be doing today would be shuffling on over to the lobby of the Blue Jays team hotel and hanging out to see who's milling about. Like if Jonathan Davis or Rowdy Tellez is there, that's going to tell me about the status of George Springer, because we don't know right now whether this quad is going to IL him again or whether he needs to sit a night or two out west before coming back later in this series with the A's, or whether he'll be good enough to go tonight. They're simply calling it fatigue.
Yeah.
But watching him run out that ground ball in his first at bat on Saturday night and grabbing for the quad as he's clearing first base, that tells me there's still something going on there that, from my layperson's perspective, is worth discussing and worrying about a little bit.
Yeah, it is, boys. You know, I was just looking at every morning now, you kind of I do the let's do the tour around baseball and see who's hurt. Like it's unbelievable what is going on this year. Like, so this is not just a Blue Jay thing. There are guys dropping like flies, and I don't know if that's because of the 60-day season last year or the 60-game season or what, but and a lot of it, you know, are hip flexors and hamstrings and, you know, soft tissue injuries, right? That's just all over the place. So again, one small, it's not much of a consolation, but Blue Jays fans, you are not alone. You know, if you're a Chicago White Sox fan today, you're looking and saying, hang on a second, I thought we were going to win a World Series this year or be a contender, and you know, two of our best players are gone for, you know, indefinitely. You know, look at the Dodgers have a shortage of pitching suddenly. You know, how could that happen? So this is part of a larger story, I think. You know, it's funny, Scott, you're talking about, you know, if you were covering this. Like, I feel for the folks trying to root out, you know, it's hard enough to kind of get clarity about player injuries in any sport now, but try doing it over a Zoom call. Yeah. Right? It's impossible. No one can cover the team properly this year. The guys, the men and women who are doing it are doing an outstanding job of, you know, creating the content and getting as close to the truth as they can. But this is not the way it should be. You're right. You should be hanging around a team hotel, or you should be at least be able to wander around the clubhouse and, as you say, see who's there and see who's not there. But yeah, the Springer thing, I'm as mystified by it as anybody. I assumed he tweaked the hamstring. I assumed that they might be overly cautious because that would be smart. Then it was when it was described as fatigue by Charlie. I don't know, you know, I'm not sure what that means in the middle of a game. Like, obviously, if he can stand up, they want him hitting. You know, you saw that the day before. He doesn't have to be 100% able to play center field to be a great offensive player, and they want him there. And I'm sure, here's the other thing, I'm sure he desperately wants to be there. That, you know, not just because he's, you know, he's a professional athlete in his prime, but, you know, he signed a monster contract, as, you know, everybody knows. And, you know, my experience is that when guys sign big free agent deals, there is a little bit of pressure to get out there. You know, maybe more than a little pressure. I know it's a weird year. They're not at home, no home fans. But you feel the obligation to get out there and earn your money. And I'm sure he's feeling that right now. So, you know, I don't think they want to put him on the IL unless they absolutely have to. And I think they will kind of tippy-toe their way through this if they can. It's just kind of, you know, it is hard to see him getting to 100% this way. But, you know, again, you're going to sit a guy down for 3 weeks to nurse a hamstring till he's 100%. I don't feel like that's going to happen either. So, I think – I'm not sure who exactly is on the taxi squad. They didn't take five guys, though, I don't think, right? They only took three, I think. So, you know, they are in Oakland, and they're, you know, they're now a continent away from the alternate site or the minor league camp. So it'd be a bit of a – you know, it would be a bit of an enterprise to get somebody quickly, you know, onto that team now. So I guess all this, I assume he's going to be in the active lineup tonight. I'm not sure I can go beyond that.
when you see situations like Springer and you have a nagging injury, how much should it be on the player to come back and how much on the team to manage, right? Because I told Scotty earlier, I'd rather Springer wait 4 or 5 days once he's 100% and have him in the field and hit at the same time rather than, okay, he feels okay today. He'll play a sim game. Then it was, okay, is he fine enough to hit? Okay, he'll DH. And then if the DH goes well after a week, then we'll have him in the field. Like, where do you find that balance, or what's the right, I guess, like who's responsible for a player coming back from injury? Is it all in the player, or should the team be responsible?
No, it's not all in the player. There's all kinds of people involved these days. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's a collective. Yeah. You know, like there's the high performance department. You know, which includes the trainers with the team. There's the front office. There's the player, and then there's the manager and the coaches and everybody. You know, it's not just the way the Jays operate this way. That's the way everybody operates now. So there's a whole lot of input here, believe me. But you know, it's hard to sit a guy down who 2 days ago hit a 471 foot home run. It's just like with a questionable hamstring. Like, how do you set him down? You know, again, you've got to be, you know, it's a 162 game season. They've obviously thought about that anyway. I think, you know, look, if opening day had been the beginning of the postseason, I think George Springer would have played. I think they would have trotted him out there. But with 162 to go, you obviously can, you know, you'd be a little more cautious. I think they would rather not inactivate him right now. You know, if it is more, you know, day to day is doesn't mean anything, but it's, you know, you hear it in sports all the time. But if this really is day to day, do you want to have to make that roster move and shut him down for 10 days minimum? You know, I think you would rather, obviously the decision has been made to try and baby their way through this instead. And, you know, there are no absolutes. And, you know, like you would know this better than, you know, civilians like us, but injury timelines in sports are guesses, right? Like, yeah, mm-hmm. there's all kinds of people who are paid to understand this, but if they knew absolutely you shut him down for 6 days, he'll be fine on the seventh day, or you activate him after 10 days, I'm sure they'd do it. But mm-hmm. I think what they're being told is, or they were told at least heading into this last series, was he's gonna be okay at the plate. He's going to be okay running the bases. You know, don't do anything crazy or overly aggressive. But let's not have him try and cover all that ground in the outfield if we don't have to. And we have alternatives, right? I guess that's the other thing. They have three guys who can play the outfield, you know, more than adequately right now. So, you know, it's not like fly balls are dropping left and right in the outfield. So you can get by with this from a competitive standpoint as well.
Do you think he comes back if the offense was firing on all cylinders? Like, you think he would have came back and just DH'd, or they would have set him out longer?
No, I think he comes back. I think he comes back when they feel he's ready. Like, they know he's going to make them better.
Yeah,
they know he's going to make them better. Again, it's not a postseason situation where you're desperate. You know, where you're on the clock. If it had made sense to wait another week, I think they would have waited another week. And, you know, their heads are above. You know, like, even if they were having a terrible April, you know, you don't make a risky decision in April to try and, you know, you don't make a risky decision in April in any case. You know, baseball seasons are too long.
With Stephen Brunn on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. A couple of topics I want to touch on, completely unrelated to each other, but both of great importance and both that deserve more time than we have, but we'll work to get through them and treat them as delicately and respectfully as possible. The Roberto Alomar situation, Stephen, is, I think, a tough one for Jays fans, but a necessary response by Major League Baseball and the Toronto Blue Jays post-investigation into the allegations of an incident or incidents which occurred in 2014. And what strikes me in the response to situations like this one, including this particular situation, is that there are some who say, well, we don't know the details. We don't know the details. So how can he be punished like this? I think the people who say that are the ones who wouldn't believe the details if the details were put out publicly. Well, it's a woman with an agenda who's after money. Well, no, this is somebody who was traumatized. So my thing is people say, well, we don't have the evidence, so how can somebody be punished? Well, no, we don't have the evidence. They do. And I think the question we need to be asking, not that it's our business to know, is we got to flip the script on the question. How bad could this have been that the team felt the need to completely walk away from Roberto Alomar, take his banner down from the rafters, take his name off the level of excellence, and how bad could this have been that Major League Baseball is severing all ties with him? I think that that educates us the extent of this deal.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot over the last few days, and, you know, again, full disclosure, like, I wrote a book with Alomar a million years ago, so back when, you know, in 93, so that's, you know, that is a lifetime ago, so there's the full disclosure. So I know Robbie Alomar a little bit, but here's, you know, and again, this is just kind of dispassionate and logical. And, you know, as you said, it was an incident from 2014 that was reported earlier this year, and then investigated by Major League Baseball this year. So this is not something that has been kicking around for, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 years. That's not that they have been working on this for months, you know, and the process has played itself out. But, you know, for anybody who's kind of in it, and it's not, you know, the burden of proof is not the same as it is in a criminal court, and nor is the requirement for, you know, disclosure. This is an employment matter. You know, this is a matter between an employee and an employer. This is not a criminal case. So, you know, anybody kind of talking about the burden of proof and all of that stuff, that's not how it works. You know, if you're in a workplace, you understand how these things work. You should. But here, Major League Baseball, for Major League Baseball to declare a Hall of Famer, a guy who I was employed as a consultant in terms of Puerto Rican baseball by the commissioner's office, a guy who is a franchise icon in one of its cities and a significant, you know, who was a star in a couple of others, to declare him ineligible, which is, you know, there is no higher punishment in baseball, you know, within the game and within the business of baseball. They would not do that lightly. It's not in their interest to do that. You know, in the kind of grand scheme of things, you know, he's a star, you know, he's a Hall of Famer. His plaque is in Cooperstown. They're not just doing this, you know, for optics, and they're not doing this flippantly, because it works contrary to the interests of baseball. No one knew anything about this. They were not putting out a public fire. This was all done, you know, very, very discreetly. You know, which was the choice of the person, of the complainant. So ask yourself why baseball would do that if they did not feel very secure in that decision or felt that they had no choice but to make that decision, right? That's just logic. So you can say whatever you want, but tell me why Rob Manfred would want to do that, you know, unless he felt he had no choice but to do it.
And lastly, Manchester United, Liverpool yesterday, a game postponed because fans stormed into Old Trafford in protest of the Glazer family ownership, which has been highly unpopular for a considerable period of time now, and in protest of the Super League that almost got started up and then died as quick a death as it was foisted upon some of the fan bases of European soccer's biggest club teams. My question, Stephen, is somewhat out of left field, to use the baseball term. Owners are all powerful. They don't fire themselves. But I wonder if, and as I ask this, I feel silly, but it fascinates me. Is there any point that things could get so bad that the Glazer family feels we got to offload this thing? Could they?
It's been bad.
Could protests? Could fans turning their back on? The thing is sports fans are addicted to the teams they love, right?
Yeah,
They'll just, always come just, back.
There's a cultural difference here, and again, it's we can go down this. This is a, probably for a whole. This would be a whole segment, but the Glazers have been despised in Manchester from the day they arrived. Right, the Glazers out signs have been there, you know, hanging at Old Trafford since the day they arrived. So the Super League thing just kind of pushed it over the top. So it's not about the Super League. This is about it is, but it isn't. You know, the Glazers, you know, who own the Tampa Bay Bucks as well, bought Manchester United and financed it off Manchester United, right? They essentially drained cash off the club to pay for the club. So let's start with that. So they're hated, right? And, you know, they're Americans, so there's a degree of kind of xenophobia there as well. But I think they're pretty much impervious to that hate because if, you know, if it had bothered them, they would have been gone a long time ago. Like, they're despised. Like, way more than... You know, when George Gillette and Buddy from Texas owned Liverpool, like that was hostile. I remember being with Gillette there, and he had armed guards with him, bodyguards.
God, yeah.
So you know, what it stems from is the idea that these are not franchises. You know, like we think of them, or the you know, we think of sports as you know things you sell, like or you acquire like a McDonald's franchise or a Tim Hortons, right? That's how we describe them. The clubs in England. The idea is that you cannot own Manchester United. The supporters own it. You know, it's their property. It's theirs. You can be the custodian of it, and you can pay the bills, but you cannot own it. It's not, you know, it's what are these things called? Non-fungible tokens or whatever. It's not something you can, yeah, it's not something you can trade around. Like now, can you? Yeah. Like people do that. They buy teams. Roman Abramovich bought Chelsea. They're, you know, mega owners, you know, the Middle Eastern guys own Manchester City and they've spent enough money to buy championships in a sport where, you know, money talks. But the culture of soccer, the culture of football, not just in England, but in the world is you cannot own this. I own this. It's my birthright, you know, as a supporter, which is why they have that rule in Germany that no private individual can own more than 49% of a team. That the supporters have to own the, you know, the other 51% is owned by the club, or you have that unique structure in Barcelona with the ownership of the football club there. So this is pushing back. Like this is a huge cultural pushback. I'm not, I don't think we'll ever go back to some form of kind of community ownership. The sport is a mega $1 billion sport. It's impossible. But, you know, it's not just they hate the Glazers and it's not just that they hate the Super League, the whole Super League fiasco. It's that, you know, people are asserting their right, you know, that this, you know, I was born here. I own this team. My ancestors own this team. This is our team. And, you know, you guys are trespassers. That's what they're saying.